readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who is very happy to welcome both Democrats and Republicans to a show all about presidential politics. After the primaries, conventions, debates, and the unrelenting media frenzy, I bet you're ready to cast your vote and get on with life. I know I could go for years without seeing another political ad. You agree? But with the election just days away, our agenda is purely political, with great titles topping our party's platform. So I say we elect to turn to page one of the book report. Come to Miami for the warm winter weather and for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books. All at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com. Based on 18 months of reporting, Bob Woodward's 17th book, The Price of Politics, is an intimate, documented examination of how President Obama and the highest-profile Republicans and Democrats in Congress attempted to restore the American economy and improve the federal government's fiscal condition over 3.5 years. Drawn from memos, meeting notes, emails, and in-depth interviews with key players, The Price of Politics addresses the central issue of the presidential and congressional campaigns, the condition of the American economy, and how and why we got here. Providing day-by-day, even hour-by-hour accounts, the book shows what really happened, what drove the debates, negotiations, and struggles that define and will continue to define the American future. Boyd Gaines narrates.
2 weeks before their inauguration, President-elect Barack Obama and Vice President-elect Joe Biden headed to Capitol Hill to meet with the Democratic and Republican leaders of the House and Senate. It was 3:15 p.m. on Monday, January 5, 2009, and Obama was fresh from a 12-day Hawaiian vacation. The leaders gathered in the ornate LBJ room of the Senate, decorated with a painting celebrating the laying of the first transatlantic cable. In it, the allegorical figures of Europe and America joined hands in friendship across the ocean. As if in that spirit, Obama called on the group to work together across the partisan divide to address the looming economic crisis. "Action on our part is urgent," he told them. Unemployment was at 7.2% and rising, and the economic situation was threatening to get worse with the financial system in full-blown crisis. He wanted the Congress to quickly pass an economic stimulus package in the range of $800 billion to $1.3 trillion. It would include some tax cuts, sweet music to the Republicans, and some investment, such as spending on roads, buildings, and other job-creating projects. In addition, he said, they had to build in medium and long-term fiscal discipline to tame the growing federal deficit. Looking at the four Republican leaders, the GOP was in the minority in both houses of Congress, Obama reached out. "I want everyone's ideas," he said, "but we can't get into political games." Nancy Pelosi, the California Democrat and Speaker of the House, interjected, "I come to Washington to work in a bipartisan manner." Both Republicans and Democrats stifled chuckles. Pelosi, a 12-term veteran of Congress and the first female speaker, was notably partisan in her leadership of the 257 House Democrats. She had been born into Democratic politics. Her father was a congressman from Maryland, and both her father and brother served as mayor of Baltimore. "We're in a unique situation," said Harry Reid, the soft-spoken but combative Senate Majority Leader. The son of a miner, Reed had grown up in the tiny town of Searchlight, Nevada, without electricity or indoor plumbing. a former amateur boxer who had faced down organized crime bosses while chair of the Nevada Gaming Commission, Reed avoided declarations about bipartisanship, adding simply, "I want to work." The Senate Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell spoke next. At 66, a veteran of five terms representing Kentucky in the Senate, McConnell was known for the ruthlessness with which he ruled the Senate Republican minority. He cut straight to his suggestions. "I like the idea of tax cuts," he said, "but we should also take a look at the money the federal government pays to the states for programs like Medicaid, the health insurance program for the poor." Beloved by the Democrats, Medicaid costs the federal government more than $250 billion a year. Perhaps, he suggested, we should treat that money as loans instead of outright grants. Having to pay the money back would make the states more judicious in spending it, he said. Obama seemed receptive. "If it works, we don't care whose idea it is," he said evenly. John Boehner, the leader of the House Republican minority, came next. Tanned from many hours on the golf course, Boehner spoke in a casual Midwestern baritone roughened by years of incessant cigarette smoking. At age 59, he was beginning his 10th term as congressman from his largely suburban district in southwestern Ohio. The second of 12 children, Boehner had grown up working in a bar owned by his grandfather and was the first person in his family to attend college, working his way through Xavier University in Cincinnati to earn a degree in business administration.
We've just heard The Price of Politics by Bob Woodward. Killing Kennedy, The End of Camelot, is a riveting historical narrative of the shocking events surrounding the assassination of JFK. This is the follow-up to Bill O'Reilly's mega best-selling Killing Lincoln. In this title, O'Reilly, with Martin Dugard, recounts in gripping detail the brutal murder of JFK and how a sequence of gunshots on a Dallas afternoon not only killed a beloved president, but also sent the nation into the cataclysmic division of the Vietnam War and its culture-changing aftermath. In January 1961, as the Cold War escalated, JFK struggled to contain the growth of communism while he learned the hardships, solitude, and temptations of what it meant to be president. He had acquired a number of formidable enemies, Khrushchev, Castro, and CIA Director Alan Dulles. In addition, powerful elements of organized crime had begun to talk about targeting the president and his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy. As we all know too well, in the midst of a 1963 campaign trip to Texas, Kennedy was gunned down by an erratic young drifter named Lee Harvey Oswald. The events leading up to this notorious crime are almost as shocking as the assassination itself. Killing Kennedy, narrated by O'Reilly, chronicles both the heroism and the deceit of Camelot.
Washington, D.C., January 20th, 1961, 12:51 p.m. The man with fewer than 3 years to live has his left hand on the Bible. Chief Justice Earl Warren stands before him, reciting the presidential oath of office. "Do you, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear?" "I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear," the new president repeats in a clipped Boston accent. His gaze is directed at the jurist whose name will one day be synonymous with Kennedy's own death. The new president, born into wealth, has a refined manner of speaking that would seem to distance himself from the electorate. But he is an enthusiastic and easily likable man's man. He joked openly about his father's vast riches during the campaign, diffusing that divisive issue with humor and candor so that average Americans would trust him when he spoke about making America better. Poor men in West Virginia heard a man from Boston say he needed their help, and they gave it. In the alien corn of Nebraska, with a familiar chopping motion of his right hand, he explained that America can be greater, and the farmers knew what he meant, one writer noted of Kennedy's broad appeal. But not everyone loves JFK. He won the popular vote over Richard Nixon by a razor-thin margin, garnering just 49% of that tally. Those farmers might have known what Kennedy meant, but 62% of Nebraskans voted for Nixon. That you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States. That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States. 80 million Americans are watching the inauguration ceremony on television. 20,000 more are there in person. 8 inches of thick, wet snow have fallen on Washington, D.C. overnight. The Army had to use flamethrowers to clear the roads. The sun now shines on the Capitol building, but a brutal wind strafes the crowd. Spectators wrap their bodies in sleeping bags, blankets, thick sweaters, and winter coats, anything to stay warm. But John Kennedy ignores the cold. He has even removed his overcoat. At age 43, JFK exudes fearlessness and vigor. His lack of coat, top hat, scarf, or gloves is an intentional ploy to burnish his athletic image. He is trim and just a shade over 6 feet tall, with greenish-gray eyes, a dazzling smile, and a deep tan, thanks to a recent vacation at his family's Palm Beach home. While JFK looks like the picture of health, however, his medical history has been troubling. Kennedy has already been administered the last rites of the Roman Catholic Church on 2 separate occasions. His medical woes will continue to trouble him in the years to come. And will to the best of your ability, and will to the best of my ability. In the sea of dignitaries and friends arrayed all around him, there are 3 people vital to JFK. Straight ahead is his younger brother and reluctant choice for Attorney General, Bobby Kennedy. The president values him more for his honesty as an advisor than for his legal ability. He knows Bobby will always tell him the truth, no matter how brutal it may be. Behind the president is the new vice president, Lyndon Johnson. It can be said, and Johnson himself believes, that Kennedy won the presidency because of this tough, tall Texan. Without Johnson on the ticket, Kennedy might never have won the Lone Star State and its treasure trove of 24 electoral votes. As it was, the Kennedy-Johnson ticket won by the slender margin of 46,000 votes in Texas, a feat that must be replicated if Kennedy is to win a second term. Finally, the new president spies his young wife, just behind Justice Warren's left shoulder. Jackie Kennedy is radiant in her suit and matching hat. Dark brown hair and a fur collar frame her unlined face. Her amber eyes sparkle with excitement. She is not showing a hint of fatigue despite staying up until 4 a.m. The booze flowed freely at pre-inaugural celebrations thrown by the likes of Frank Sinatra and Leonard Bernstein. Jackie returned to their house in Georgetown long before the parties wound down, but her husband did not accompany her. When Jack finally showed up just before 4 a.m., he found his wife wide awake, too excited to sleep.
That was Killing Kennedy by Martin Dugard and Bill O'Reilly. Ann Coulter has been doing all the talk shows lately, promoting her newest book, Mugged. The Book Report has never previewed a book by this supremely opinionated lady. Though, her How to Talk to a Liberal, If You Must, was a pretty tempting choice for our political show. But I've been checking all the reviews, and the Coulter book folks seem to be the most enthusiastic about is Demonic, How the Liberal Mob is Endangering America. The demon is a mob, and the mob is demonic. The Democratic Party activates mobs, depends on mobs, coddles mobs, publicizes and celebrates them, and in fact, it is the mob. Sweeping in its scope, and like all Coulter's books, relentless in its argument, Demonic explains the oddities of liberals as standard groupthink behavior. To understand mobs is to understand liberals. Do we on the Book Report understand? We'll see. Elizabeth White narrates.
The Democrats' playbook doesn't involve heads on pikes, as yet, but uses a more insidious means to incite the mob. The twisting of truth, stirring of passions, demonizing of opponents, and relying on propagandistic images in lieu of ideas, these are the earmarks of a mob leader. Over and over again, one finds the Democrats manipulating the mob to gain power. It is official Democratic policy to appeal to the least informed, most weak-minded, and perpetually alarmed members of the public. Their base consists of soccer moms, actresses, felons, MSNBC viewers, both of them, non-English speakers, welfare recipients, heads up their butts billionaires, and government workers who can never be laid off. The entire party gave up on attracting the votes of white men decades ago. It's easier to round up votes by frightening women about assault weapons and promising excellent free health care to non-English speakers. Yes, a free health care system that is so superior that Democrats exempt themselves and their friends from having to be in it. Liberals frighten people about their health care in order to stampede through Obamacare. They claim the earth is overheating in order to seize taxpayer money for solar panels and compact fluorescent light bulbs. They call out union thugs to force politicians to accede to insane benefits packages. They stage campaigns of calumny to get their way on gay marriage. Faddish ideas that would never have occurred to anyone 50 years ago, or even 20 years ago, are suddenly foisted on the rest of us by the liberal mobs. Although the left in America is widely recognized as hysterical, unreasonable, and clueless, the root cause of these traits has generally been neglected. More than a century ago, Gustave Le Bon perfectly captured the liberal psychological profile in his 1896 book, The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind. Le Bon, a French physician, scientist, and social psychologist, was the first to identify the phenomenon of mass psychology. His groundbreaking book, The Crowd, paints a disturbing picture of the behavior of mobs. Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini used his book to learn how to incite a mob. Our liberals could have been Le Bon's study subjects. Even the left-wing Guardian has admitted that Le Bon's study of crowd behavior was possibly the most influential work of psychology ever written. Presumably recognizing themselves in his psychological profile, liberals have recently tried to undermine Le Bon. They have complained that he merely articulated the propertied class's fear of the mob. Who likes mobs? Renters? Window manufacturers? Rope salesmen? Liberals also objected that Le Bon did not hold the police accountable for a mob's behavior, which is like demanding that we take into account the length of the rape victim's skirt. It is revealing that liberals so fear Le Bon that they try to sully him as controversial and reactionary. Those particular complaints, incidentally, were lodged by liberal activist George Monbiot, who has called for citizens' arrests of former government officials from George W. Bush's UN ambassador John Bolton to former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. No wonder he doesn't like psychological studies of mob behavior. It was all the usual claptrap, but the piercing truth of Le Bon's study speaks for itself. Liberals wouldn't go after him if, even a century later, his theories didn't still ring true. All the characteristics of mob behavior set forth by Le Bon in 1895 are evident in modern liberalism.
We've just heard Demonic by Ann Coulter. Is a single, 20-something, gun-loving, Christian Republican writer and blogger, the daughter of a senator and the 2008 Republican presidential nominee. He is a married, 40-year-old, gun-fearing, atheist, Democratic comedian, the son of a lesbian and former Social Security employee. Meghan McCain and Michael Ian Black barely knew each other. But they hope their book, America, You Sexy Bitch, A Love Letter to Freedom, can impact the way politics is discussed in America. Last summer, McCain and Black embarked on a cross-country tour. Along the way, they spoke to politicians, gun lovers, abortion right advocates and opponents, gay parents, flag burners, Muslims, tea partiers, veterans, bikers, fast food workers, and a hooker or two. They toured the White House. They fired semi-automatic weapons. They stopped and ate at every Olive Garden along the way. But mostly, they talk to each other about their differences and their similarities. Think of it as Chelsea Handler meets Hunter S. Thompson in a political cannonball run across America. The authors narrate.
Half an hour after taking the Ambien, I am elbow deep into a bag of Tostitos and cruising my Twitter account. 1.7 million followers. Not bragging. Just saying. Okay, bragging. Follow me, at Michael Ian Black. When I notice that Meghan McCain has just posted something, I respond to her. She responds to me. Then the Ambien seizes my fingers and types the following. We should write a book together. After a few moments, she writes back. Sure! Exclamation mark. The exclamation mark makes me think she isn't serious because exclamation marks are rarely the sign of a serious thought. I write back. I'm serious. Around dawn, I wake up on the couch covered in Tostitos crumbs and stumble upstairs to join my wife, Martha, in bed. Something is troubling me, though, something I had perhaps done under the influence of a powerful sleeping agent. Just before falling back to sleep, I realize what it is. I think I have just proposed writing a book with a woman, a Republican woman, I have never actually met, based on the dubious facts that I once said something nice about her on TV, she seems cool, and my friend Joe liked her new haircut. The woman in question is also the daughter of the other guy in the last presidential election. Moreover, I'm pretty sure she said sure! Exclamation mark.
When Michael first popped the question on Twitter, I thought that this project could be a significant endeavor, to try and showcase two entirely different perspectives and backgrounds in a civil and funny manner, while attempting to tackle the bigger picture problems and issues currently facing this country. All of it was right up my alley, and it was an easy decision to make. Attempting to fuse two different perspectives and worlds is pretty much what I spend my life attempting to do. So that's why I said yes so quickly. I loved the notion of teaming up with someone I barely knew and probably would not have gotten a chance to work with or really know in any significant way if we had not elected to embark on this project. We wanted to use ourselves as guinea pigs in order to look at what is going on in America, politically and culturally. Our country is going through unbelievably difficult and tenuous times, and it sometimes feels like we are becoming more polarized and angry at each other than ever before. There had to be a way to make a connection between divergent points of view and to then take the unity out on the road as a way to hear Americans through fresh ears. More than anything, I was enticed by the spontaneity of this plan. Ever since the election, I have had a Jones to be back out on the road. So the chance to go where no one has gone before while using our fledgling relationship as an experiment in bipartisan mixology was a golden and bizarre opportunity to try something new and unique. I needed no convincing. It really was as simple as sure.
So here I am, about a month later, crammed into a coach seat somewhere above the checkerboard squares of the American heartland. From up here, the country looks vast and peaceful. I cannot see any foreclosure notices, no methamphetamine labs. There aren't any televisions on this plane, so I can't watch left screaming at right on cable news. No internet, no Drudge, no HuffPo. Just a plane full of passengers heading to the same destination. It's a decent, albeit shallow, metaphor for the way I'd like my country to be. The people on this plane probably have no more in common than anybody else. Or, I guess the more optimistic way to say it is that they have just as much in common as people everywhere. We're probably all American, or at least mostly American. We probably all love our families. We are probably all glad we're not still at LaGuardia, one of our nation's worst airports. Beyond that, I know that we share at least one important goal. First and foremost, we'd like the plane not to crash. All this common ground below us. It's hard to get a sense of America's size from the air. It's only on the ground, driving across, that you really get a feel for the enormity of our country. It's a big place. Big. The first time I became aware of this fact was when I was 19 years old and traveling the country as a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. In fact, my love of country came as a direct result of that first road trip. Until then, I hadn't really thought much about America one way or another.
That was America, You Sexy Bitch, by Michael Ian Black and Meghan McCain. My guest today, Victor Kahn, is a professor of English at Skidmore College. He's written books on Shakespeare, critical volumes on Tom Stoppard and Harold Pinter, and now Soundbites, a novel about politics and the media. Timely reading for Election Week. Welcome, Victor. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So what made you move away from Shakespeare to write Soundbites? I'm sure you weren't bored by the Bard.
No. I'm still compelled by Shakespeare, but I've always been very interested in politics. And these last few years, I guess I've become addicted to talk shows and various things like that. And I just wanted to dramatize my feelings about the shows and the media and politics and everything that's going on around me. And I wanted to try a different kind of form, and that's why I came up with Soundbites, which is a novel structured exactly in that, in media soundbites. It's all television and radio and commentary, but just the dialogue that we hear, no descriptions or anything else like that. And I think the story we tell is an interesting one and relates very much to what's going on today.
Well, as you say, the media is such a big part of your book. So do you really feel that they're kind of mindless talking heads, or is there something darker at work here?
Well, I think there are a couple of things going on. One, when you listen to these shows, and we can pick right or left, radio, television, any of them, the voices are never listening to one another. They're all going at the same time, and everybody's just trying to get in their point of view. The second thing is, on so many of these shows, they make it sound as if we're going to have exciting guests who are going to say something surprising or unusual. And in fact, everybody, or virtually everyone who comes on these shows, is eminently predictable in what they will say. And what you have is just the voices going back and forth. Whether something darker is at play, I'm not sure. I suspect there is. I can't put my finger exactly on it. But I think our culture has become so soundbite-oriented that we've lost looking at the bigger picture, lost the sense of really discussing ideas, and we talk in terms of rumor and theory and everything else. And, of course, there are no real referees for these things. Nobody's actually checking up and being a central control that can say, wait a minute, something wrong was just said. It all just flows over us, and the public is inundated with a tidal wave of ideas and words, and it's not easy to sort out reality from fantasy.
Well, Cassie McClellan is your main character. Is there a little bit of Sarah Palin in Cassie?
I think there's a little bit of Sarah Palin, a little bit of Michelle Bachman is in there. I wanted to be very careful, though. I didn't make her a cartoon character. She's a bright woman. And she has very seriously held opinions, which she articulates very effectively. And liberal friends of mine have told me, you really made her a convincing figure. She's not simply a joke. She's got serious ideas. We don't necessarily agree with the ideas, but she's a substantial person. And I also didn't want to idealize the liberal candidate, who's roughly based a little bit on Ted Kennedy, perhaps. But each of them has weaknesses, each of them has strengths, and it's the going back and forth, which to me makes the story interesting, that you really don't know who's going to win, and each one has points in their favor. And I tried to make them realistic figures, not simply cartoons.
Well, okay. Along the way to her U.S. Senate win, Cassie was involved with abortion issues, gun control, labor disputes, medical records theft, exposing her opponent's infidelity, and possibly tampering with votes. Quite a campaign trail. In your opinion, do all national races have this many shenanigans?
I think I was mild.
Oh, gosh.
I have a feeling there's so much going on behind the scenes that I'm just a member of the public. But I think we at the public have so little idea what's going on. I mean, with all the shows going on all day long, I still think we have very, very little idea of what's really going on in these campaigns. And when I read about the various voter, well, let's call it suppression maneuvers and all the different things, what's going on behind closed doors, I suspect would terrify most of us. And here, I admit, the campaign I dramatized in the novel is full of incidents and fun and humor and wild events taking place. I had a lot to get in one story. But I think they're all basically realistic. I'm not sure. I don't think any of them are total fantasies that came out strictly of my imagination. I think they're things that have happened that are still happening in virtually every campaign. And so often I look at the news and I hear a line or I hear a story or a theme and I go, wait a minute, that's right out of the book.
Yeah.
And I know it's a packed campaign. Things go back and forth. But these issues are just overflowing. And I think all the issues we discuss in the book are there. If we looked at all the different campaigns running across the country, I think these issues are there. I may have put a few together, but they're all out there and dominating campaigns.
Now, is the takeaway you want folks to get from your book is that we need election reform?
I'm not sure we can ever have that much reform. I think it's one of the bonuses and one of the penalties is that we have such free speech and there are so many ideas going back and forth. I guess what I'm hoping is that people will be able to sort out the truth from the fantasy, be able to see when they hear candidates speak, when they listen to analysis, that they'll be able to ask themselves questions. Wait a minute, who's really making sense? Are we hearing logical comments? Are we hearing intelligent commentary, or are we just hearing noise? And I guess I'm asking the public and hoping the public will be more self-critical, more critical of their candidates, and more analytic, that we just don't take the first thing that's said, but that we go and we reason and we think things out and we really listen to what's said rather than just take immediate impressions.
As a college professor, have your students been as involved with this election as they were in 2008?
Well, I'm on leave from teaching right now, so I can't give you a study, but I can tell you this. Well, you mentioned that I teach Shakespeare before, and I teach a lot of Shakespeare's history plays. And whenever we do Shakespeare's history plays, we always relate it to who's ever in office. I've been teaching these plays now for more than 30 years. And it doesn't matter who's in office, but Republican or Democrat, conservative, liberal, the parallels to contemporary culture are overwhelming. And my students are very alert to what the candidates are saying when we talk about these issues, and that they remember Gore Bush, and they remember, and they certainly know Clinton, of course, but they remember Reagan, and they've seen tapes of Reagan and Carter, and they know all these people, and they're interested in it. They're very involved in the way that the history plays reflect the political culture of today. So I would say, yes, they are involved.
Readers, I want to let you know that Soundbites is funny and biting and the perfect read for this time of year. Victor, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Master of the Senate, The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Volume 1, spotlights Johnson's story through one of its most remarkable periods, 1949 to 1960, his 12 years in the U.S. Senate. The book report previewed Caro's most recent title, The Passage of Power, this past summer, and you'll find that sample on archived shows, bookreportradio.com, week of July 7th, 2012. For our political show this week, I wanted to bring you this Pulitzer Prize-winning title that started this series. When Johnson arrived in its chambers, the Senate had become a parody of itself and an obstacle that had blocked much-needed liberal legislation for decades.
Caro shows how Johnson's brilliance, charm, and ruthlessness enabled him to become the youngest and most powerful majority leader in history. He used his legislative genius to cajole and threaten both Northern liberals and Southern conservatives to pass the first civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. Weaving rich detail into a gripping narrative, Caro gives us a portrait of Johnson and a definitive study of the workings of legislative power. Grover Gardner narrates.
Margaret Frost left the room quietly, and she never sued or took any other legal action to try to force the board to register her. Doing so, however, would almost certainly not have helped. In August 1957, black Americans in the South who were denied the right to vote and who asked a lawyer, if they could find a lawyer who would take their case, what law would assist them to do so, were informed that there was no such law. And that information was accurate. Summarizing the situation, a study made that same year by the United States Department of Justice concluded that there is no adequate legal remedy for a person who had been denied a registration certificate by a county board of registrars. The scene that had occurred in the Eufaula courthouse was not an unusual one in the American South in 1957. After the Civil War, almost a century before, there had been an attempt to make black Americans more a part of their country, to give them the basic rights of citizens, which included, of course, a citizen's right to vote. And in 1870, the 15th Amendment to the Constitution had supposedly guaranteed that right, forbidding any state to deny or abridge the right of citizens to vote because of their race or color. But the amendment proved to be an insufficient guarantee in the 11 southern states that had seceded from the Union and formed the Rebel Confederacy. Specific laws to give the amendment force and make it meaningful, federal laws, since there was no realistic possibility that any southern state would pass an effective statute, were going to be necessary. During the 87 years since the 15th Amendment had been ratified, scores, indeed hundreds, of proposed federal laws had been introduced in the Congress of the United States to ensure that black Americans would have, in fact as well as theory, the right to vote. Not one of these bills had passed, and in Barber County, in which there were approximately equal numbers of black Americans and white Americans, out of 7,158 blacks of voting age in 1957, exactly 200, one out of 35, had the right to vote, while 6,521 whites had that right. In Alabama as a whole, out of 516,336 blacks who were eligible to vote, only 52,336, little more than 1 out of 10, had managed to register. For the 11 southern states as a whole, out of more than 6 million blacks eligible to vote, only 1,200,000, 1 out of 5, had registered. And of course, even those blacks who had registered to vote often didn't dare go to the polls to cast ballots because of fear of violence or economic retaliation. In 1957, there were scores of counties in the South which had tens of thousands of black residents, but in which, in some elections, not a single vote had been cast by a black. The room in another city, 800 miles to the northeast, in Washington, D.C., was hardly more impressive than the Eufaula County Clerk's office. It was L-shaped, and the short leg of the L was lined with telephone booths only slightly larger than conventional booths and distinguished from them only by a small light bulb above each one that was lit when the booth was in use. The other leg, the main part of the room, was narrow and drab, its two long walls a pale tan in color and undecorated except for a few black and white lithographs and dull green draperies. Aside from a rickety little desk and a small fireplace on the right wall and a pair of swinging doors on the left, both walls were lined with couches and armchairs covered in cracked brown leather, and they were set so close together that their arms almost touched. On the room's far wall, however, was a feature that didn't fit in with the rest of the furnishings, a huge mirror. Twice as tall as a man and wide enough to fill almost the entire wall, bordered in a broad frame of heavy gold leaf, it was a mirror out of another age, a mirror large enough for a man to watch as he swirled a cloak around himself, and to check the way it sat on his shoulders, or, having removed the cloak and handed it to a waiting page boy, to check every detail of his appearance before he pushed open those swinging doors. And when those doors swung open, suddenly, framed between them in the instant before they swung shut again, were long arcs of darkly glowing mahogany, semicircles of desks, whose deep reddish-brown surfaces had been burnished so highly that they gleamed richly with the reflection of lights in the ceiling high above them. There were 96 desks. The narrow room, drab though it was one of the cloakrooms, the Democratic cloakroom, of the United States Senate. The cloakroom was generally rather empty, a comfortable, comradely place whose manners as well as furniture resembled those of a men's club. The only woman among the 96 senators was a Republican, a place of handshaking and back-slapping and bluff camaraderie. A sleepy place, literally sleepy, since among the dozen or so senators present on a typical afternoon, several elderly men might be taking naps in the armchairs. In that August of 1957, however, the cloakroom was often crowded, with senators talking earnestly on sofas and standing in animated little groups. And sometimes the glances between various groups were not comradely at all. Sometimes, in fact, they glinted with a barely concealed hostility, and the narrow room simmered with tension.
We've just heard Master of the Senate, The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Volume 1, by Robert A. Caro. In The Reagan I Knew, the late William F. Buckley Jr. offers a reminiscence of a 30-year friendship with the man who brought the American conservative movement out of the political wilderness and into the White House. During this political season, I bet you've missed Buckley's distinctive voice. He was truly one of a kind. Reagan and Buckley were political allies and close friends throughout Reagan's political career. They went on vacations together and shared insider jokes. For all the words that have been written about him, Ronald Reagan remains an enigma. His former speechwriter Peggy Noonan called him a paradox all the way down, and even his son despaired of ever truly knowing him. But Reagan was not an enigma to William F. Buckley. They understood each other for decades. Malcolm Hilgartner narrates.
15 years later, completely by accident, I had written something in Esquire that had impressed George H.W. Bush's press secretary. I found myself working in Ronald Reagan's White House. The Reagans kindly invited me to the odd social occasion. On one of these, I very nearly made a faux pas of national proportion. The invitation was for dinner in the residence upstairs and a movie afterward. I had a big speech to write for Bush that night, and pleaded urgently with Muffy Brandon, Mrs. Reagan's social secretary, to be excused from the movie. She tisk-tisked, but said, "All right, but I must be discreet about leaving." I said, "Of course." As I made my stealthy exit just before the lights went down in the family theater, I rounded a corner in the hallway and bumped smack into Ronald Reagan, who was returning either from the men's room or from ordering a richly deserved missile strike on some Mideastern despot. He smiled that 1,000-watt smile and regarded me with a look of mild surprise. "Where are you going?" he said. "We're about to start the movie." I dissembled. "Just, going to the men's room, sir. I'll be right there. Go ahead and start without me." He smiled and went off, phalanxed by Secret Service, including Tim McCarthy, who a few months earlier had interposed himself between the president and John Hinckley. I made my way down the long corridor in the basement and was about to exit the White House when I heard behind me a sibilant and very stressed, "Psst!" Looking back, I saw Muffy Brandon frantically gesticulating. "He just announced to everyone that we weren't going to start without you." "Oh, my God." I skulked back, Muffy more or less leading me by the ear, to find 50 guests glowering at me, and my seat saved, in the front row, next to the president and Mrs. Reagan. I experienced dozens of such random acts of grace and favor during my time at the White House. Looking back on it, I realize, not that I didn't at the time, that these were reciprocations for the kindnesses that Pup had shown to the Reagan's children. A few years later, in 1985, I found myself, again accidentally, ghostwriting David Stockman's memoirs under furious deadline pressure. I use the term ghostwriting in the narrowly technical sense. My job was to turn a mountain, yea, a veritable Kilimanjaro, of manuscript into readable English. There was a certain piquancy to this assignment, inasmuch as David Stockman had become hugely famous for an act of impertinence to Reagan while serving as his budget director. But, A, Stockman's beef was never ad hominem against Reagan, and anyway, B, I needed the dough. In the midst of this death march fell National Review's gala 30th anniversary dinner at the Plaza in New York. I pleaded with Pup that I couldn't attend. I barely had time to eat meals. No, he insisted, you have to be there. As he put it somewhat mysteriously, for reasons that will become apparent. I grumpily assented. Pup wasn't someone you could really say no to. That's another story. So I went, and was seated right above the podium when he gave the speech that is reproduced here. Looking back on that moment, on those two amazing men, I reflect that yes, the blood of the fathers truly did run strong. Christopher Buckley, Washington, D.C., May 2008.
That was a preview of The Reagan I Knew by William F. Buckley, Jr.
Weather.
And for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books. All at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
For more than 20 years since his bestseller, Don't Know Much About History, first appeared, Kenneth Davis has shown that Americans don't hate history, just a crashingly dull version dished out in school. In Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, Davis turns his attention to what is arguably the most important and most fascinating subject in American history. From the curious election of George Washington in 1789 through the meteoric rise of Barack Obama, the presidency has been at the heart of American history. From the lowlights to the bright lights, from the intellectuals to the disasters, Davis tells all the stories. He uses his entertaining Q&A style to chart the history of the presidency, debunk the myths of American leaders, and recount the stories of these very real people. History buffs and history phobes alike will enjoy this title, performed by an ensemble cast.
Why did George Washington lead troops into the field as president?
The Founding Fathers hated taxes, right? That's why they declared their independence. Many Americans believe that modern America is unfairly and aggressively overtaxed by an unrelenting and oppressive central government, just as the 13 colonies were. But as the run-up to the Constitutional Convention proved, many of those rebellious founders and framers knew that they could not govern without funds to run a government and keep an army. And you can't get enough revenue without duly authorized taxes. Certainly George Washington understood that, and he would lead an army to defend that principle. One piece of Hamilton's plan for restoring the American economy was to raise revenue through excise taxes on American-made products. There was no income tax, and there would be none until the Civil War. It was considered unconstitutional and would later be overturned by the Supreme Court. Hamilton's first target was whiskey, most typically distilled from corn, and the Whiskey Act became law in March 1791. Guess what? Some people didn't like it. And the ones who liked it least were farmers in the western states and territories who used their surplus corn to make whiskey. It was cheaper to distill it than transport corn east for sale. Add to this the resentment that Westerners felt that the government was not doing enough to protect them from attacks by Native American nations. And there was a powerful discontent growing. That discontent had been the source of Shays' Rebellion and other backwoods revolts. It would remain a constant in American history. People who believe the government is working for the moneyed interests and not for them. By 1794, what had been a protest of the whiskey tax was growing into larger anti-government sentiment, with echoes of Shays' Rebellion. In July 1794, the protest grew deadly when several militiamen sent to arrest one of the Whiskey Rebellion leaders were killed. In August, some 7,000 farmers, or rebels to the authorities, met near Pittsburgh, planning to march on the town. Watching with growing alarm, Washington ordered Secretary of War Henry Knox to call out more than 12,000 militiamen. He put Virginia Governor Henry Lee in command of the operation. But in late September, President Washington donned his uniform and rode to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, to review the situation. After inspecting the troops and seeing to conditions in the camps, Washington returned to Philadelphia. Although he did not actually lead any troops into battle, Washington had command of a force five times as large as the army he took into many of his revolutionary battles. The overwhelming show of force diffused the situation with the arrest of a handful of the rebels, with very little concern for liberties, due process, or any of the other niceties supposedly guaranteed by the Bill of Rights. Two men were sentenced to hang, but were pardoned by Washington. Summarizing his actions in this crisis, Washington later wrote, "If the laws are to be so trampled upon with impunity, and the minority is to dictate to the majority, there is an end put at one stroke to Republican government." A few years after suppressing the Whiskey Rebellion, George Washington started a new enterprise back at Mount Vernon, a distillery of his own. The operation began producing whiskey in 1797, just before Washington left the presidency. Operated by six slaves under the direction of Mount Vernon's Scottish farm manager, James Anderson, it was the largest distillery in America at the time, producing 11,000 gallons of whiskey in 1799. The distillery passed to Washington's heirs but burned to the ground in 1814. After archaeologists excavated the site in the 1990s, the distillery was rebuilt and completed in 2007. It is now in operation once more.
That was Don't Know Much About the American Presidents by Kenneth C. Davis. No matter your party affiliation, you've got to admit Stephen Colbert has a unique worldview. In America Again, Rebecoming the Greatness We Never Weren't, Colbert proposes the following theory. As perfect as America is in every single way, America is broken. And we can't even exchange it because we're 236 years past the 30-day return window. Look around. We don't make anything anymore. Our future is mortgaged to China. Where and how did we lose our way? Luckily, America Again will single-bookedly pull this country back from the brink. Covering subjects ranging from healthcare to the economy, Stephen gives America the dose of truth it needs to get back on track. Colbert narrates with Tim Meadows and Jordan Ruderman.
America is exceptional. Does that statement shock you? It shocks me to have to say it. To be forced by your doubt to say out loud that America is exceptional implies something ugly. It's like telling the host of a dinner party, "I'm certain your wife is a female." Saying it out loud just feels wrong, no matter how big her hands are. Plus, the word is shouldn't even be in there. It's putting too much distance between America and exceptional. Americeptional. That's better. Plus, it saves time. Time we could be spending with our kids. Now, I hear what you're feeling. But, Stephen, is America really exceptional? The world is full of countries. I'm sure a lot of them are pretty good. Well, yeah, if countries are your thing, I'm sure there are thousands of countries out there. You want to live in a country? Move someplace else. You want to live in America? This is the only game in town. As Newt Gingrich once pinched out, quote, America's greatness, America's exceptional greatness, is not based on that fact that we are the most powerful, most prosperous, and most generous nation on earth. Rather, those things are the result of American exceptionalism. Amen. America is exceptional because of our greatness. And the source of all that greatness is just how exceptional we are. And the entire world knows we're exceptional, and not just because we give them a steady supply of losing Super Bowl team t-shirts and sitcoms about doughy guys with hot wives. We are an unwavering beacon of limitless freedom, which people the world over see and say, I want to live there. I want to be an American. That's why we must erect a 40-foot-high, 2,000-mile-long, 10,000-volt electric fence to keep those people out. There's only so much limitless freedom to go around. Ronald Reagan said it first. America is the shining city upon a hill. And no matter how dark our days or how low we sink, we will always be shiny and hilly. Reagan also said, I have always believed that there was some divine plan that placed this great continent between two oceans to be sought out by those who are possessed of an abiding love of freedom and a special kind of courage. And he's right. America was put here by God for us to find. America was like the sculpture existing inside the block of marble, waiting for the artist to chip away a few Cherokee to find it. Some people don't believe in American exceptionalism. Some people won't stand up for America. They think that there are things in our history to be ashamed of. But I'm sorry, America is good at everything except one thing, apologizing. Why should we apologize? Everything we've ever done has ended up creating the greatest country in the world. Ergo, everything we did was the best possible choice. Besides, hindsight is 20/20. What does that mean? I don't know. We'll have to wait until the year 2020 to find out. But ask yourself this. What would America have been like if it had been run by the lefty apologists from the get-go? Would we have grown into an agricultural powerhouse without our unpaid African internship program? No. Would we have conquered the West if we had overregulated the pioneers? No. And who wants their good crowned by brotherhood from sea to shining Scranton? No thanks. Throughout human history, countries rise and fall, but not America. We continue to rise and rise like dough until Jesus bakes us in the fiery afterscape of the rapture. Now, I don't know about you, but I feel like if there were a better place, God would have put me in it. The point is, America has faced hardships in the past, but we have always mounted a comeback. We defeated the Nazis. We defeated the Native Americans. We defeated the environment. We even defeated the metric system. Kilos? Sorry, that's drug talk. This is America, where we eat fruit by the foot, not muesli by the meter.
That was America Again by Stephen Colbert. Readers, you know I usually end each week's show with a suggestion that you settle into a comfy spot with a great book. This week, I'm encouraging you to do that after you visit the polls and cast your vote for the candidate of your choice. It's our duty and our privilege, and even after all these months and years of rhetoric, it's what makes our country great. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here in 1 week for the next edition of The Book Report.